To some extent, they could be organized on that basis. I mean, they need higher wages, better working conditions. But to some extent, they could be organized on things that would be exclusively women's issues. And to some extent, something, you know, interacting both, because they are in both situations.
Maybe the way to, well, I guess there are two things I'd like to say. I'd sort of like this to be a general discussion, not dialogue, but it's too tempting to respond. But two kinds of responses. One, I don't at all want to reject the Marxist notions. That is, what I'm really trying to do is to figure out how, I mean, I meant interactive, I really meant interactive. That is, I didn't mean we should set these aside and move to something else. What I meant is that we really should try to sort of develop a theory which can be encompassing of both frameworks. So I just want to say that, since it seems to be a little bit of a misunderstanding. But the second thing I want to say is by way of illustration. Among the sort of issues that I'm engaged with right now is the issue of how scientific management affects workers, male and female. And what seems to be emerging in sort of the beginning of a kind of you know, sort of general survey, both of the work other people have done and of my own research in scientific management. Scientific management is, you know?
Taylorism,
right, that is the...
Okay.
Scientific management is the introduction into the workplace of efficiency techniques, which normally involve time and motion studies, the division of work along very specific and particular lines, so that one worker does one function. And in its Taylorist method, it was sort of an attempt to find the one best way to do any particular task. What it essentially did was to remove any decision-making process from the worker. So it's sometimes accompanied by or called the de-skilling process. It takes skills away from workers and puts them into the heads and the hands of management. It turns workers, makes it implies that workers have no initiative at all on the workplace, but simply do rote work. And its introduction in the U.S. generally occurred around the First World War in the 1920s, when lots of sort of major companies sort of began to adopt scientific management efforts. Well, what it looks as though it happens is that workers, male, tend to resist scientific management efforts on the grounds of what we would roughly or loosely call worker control issues. That is, they did not like the fact that the skill was being taken away from them. And they did not like the fact that that decisions that they could make, they could no longer make. And in fact, so great was the resistance among numbers of groups of workers that management frequently responded simply by firing all the skilled workers and introducing unskilled workers because they were more tractable and easy to deal with. In other words, workers, male, respond to scientific management by resisting the removal of their skills. Workers, female, however, seem to respond. Now, you know, this is only the beginning of something that I would not wish to write at this moment, but it does seem to me to be true, or to have more truth than falsity in it. They seem to respond partly because they are de facto, in early 20th century industry, less skilled than male workers. They seem to respond not to the indignities inflicted upon them in terms of removal of skill, that is, not to worker control issues, but to two things. They respond to the way in which worker control, or sorry, the way in which scientific management eliminates the sort of group process with which women had constructed the workplace. That is, the capacity of women to work together in teams, the way in which scientific management often operated on the basis of bonus systems and piecework rates, which pitted women against each other, and so on. So they do not go out on strike over the speed-ups, over the intensive work they have to do, over the boredom of the work, over the absence of initiative, but they do tend to go out on strike over those issues. And secondly, they do tend to respond to workplace condition issues. That is, they respond positively when scientific management, although it reduces the real satisfactions of work in terms of what women can actually do in the workplace, if it is accompanied by lunchrooms downstairs, or newly painted workrooms, cleanliness, or a place to hang one's hat and coat instead of dumping it on the chair behind you, you know, the institution of cloakrooms. In other words, amenities at work, which men don't seem to give a damn about, women care a lot about, right? And indeed, in one instance, you know, there's great competition. This is in the cigar industry. There's great competition between two plants in Detroit, which are both turning to scientific management in the early 1920s, where one competes with the other. Neither of them ever discusses raising wages or creating changes in the actual work situation, but one installs showers, and then the other one installs a lunchroom, and then the other one installs a cloakroom for women to hang their coats, and then the third one gives them a the third one allows them to move between floors when they have their lunch break so they can go have lunch with their friends, you see, and those are the issues that they fight over. So anyway, the point of all that is just to suggest that it's that there may be something in the way women approach the workplace which is different from the way men approach the workplace, and that those, and that that approach may really come out of expectations of work which derive from some other place. And that's what I meant when I said, really, that's the connection that one, you know, has to look for. Because if one then looks at those women and says, as the Women's Bureau in fact did in the 1920s, and said, what's the matter with those women? They're speeding up the work process and nobody's going out on strike, never understanding that they weren't going out on strike because accompanied by the speed up was some other amenity which appealed to some other place in the woman. And that's, I guess.
I'm having some trouble with an implication I get from your last talk, which is that women can be satisfied with these little amenities if that is all that they ever care about. I mean, you've avoided the idea of women struggling around wages. And the real concrete struggle. And using the whole idea of amenities is to make it less concrete in my own hearing, at least. I think we can address why women don't or do not engage in struggles at the same level around wages as they did around men. Or why they could be bought off with amenities, which has to do with recognition of how little their labor was valued, just the limitation to the struggle for wages, the built-in notion of human responsibility.
I know I'm going to get myself into trouble, but what I really want to say in response to that question is, what makes you think that amenities are little? In other words, what makes you think that those conditions at work are less meaningful than an extra 10 cents an hour?
The reason
right?
why I will say is that they're treating culture as less important.
Yes, but that's exactly what's wrong, right? That's exactly what...
I'm not sure that that's
Go ahead, sorry.
I'm not going to say that amenity is less important, or not important, but I'm also going to say that a wage is more important than a particular amenity at a certain point in time, especially when women are finding themselves in less structurally important jobs, where they're also in need of supporting families being
I agree. You see, I would respond to that by saying, yeah, I mean, at certain points in time and for certain women and for certain kinds of women, the wage is, of course, the thing that's important. I mean, we saw that, for example, in the Yale struggle. So I would never want to argue that that was not the case. What I would want to argue is that there are some moments in time and some groups of women workers. These women tended to be young, single women who lived at home with families. And for some groups of women, when other issues are important, and that we can't understand how women respond to the workplace unless we understand the totality of what's important to them. You see, I don't want to undermine. I think wages are crucially important to lots of women, lots of the time, and so are working hours and so on. But there are other times when other issues are at least equally
important. You should define the group you're talking about, Alice.
Well, right, but what then one would have to become, right, that one would have to become quite historically specific, which I could try to do, or Carol
sure
could do
could
in terms of.
I think there's also another danger. In the late 1960s in England, when they were introducing scientific management to a number of plants in England, it was overwhelmingly men. for example, the men struck over the institution of the tea break. And I think that that challenges your notion of, I mean, I agree with the idea that the amenity, you know, one person's amenity is another person's wage, in one sense, and the tea break did represent that.
Yes.
But in this case, in these cases, exactly the automobile industry, where the male workers were getting higher wages in return for giving up the tea break.
Right.
And I remember I was a student at the school, and I sort of, you know, think of, you know, America. Men pouring tea and being so unmasculine and all this sort of stuff. And when it was explained, it was the tea break, where it was the only chance for the men to get together to talk about union issues or just to socialize.
Right.
One understood how important the tea break was. And I think that that may also challenge this notion of, well, it's just women who struggle over that issue. The other thing which, and this is getting on a different track, but when I studied women in England and in the United States in the garment industry, this was a few years back, and I could be wrong, but my impression from the statistics is that women entered the paid labor force roughly the age of 16 and stayed in until they started having children. That is, they didn't leave just because they were married, but once childbearing. After a certain period of time, they re-entered the paid labor force and worked until they were really too old or until they died. And I think that this also may challenge the notion that women didn't work except for a brief period of time, but that they really did work with the exception of the childbearing year. And I think this has implications for the whole debate over Marx and the family wage. But I think you may be wrong in arguing that men's work can be challenged, because I think even while men's work was interrupted by unemployment and by injury and by moving, I think the assumption of the society was that men had to work, that men's life was work. And the assumption for women was that women's life was not for work, but was primarily for reproduction. And an unemployed man, the assumption was he still had to work even though he was unemployed, he was ill. And I think that I'd be concerned about that line of thinking, because I think then it blurs the distinction between the role of women and the role of men.
Yeah. Let me respond to that. That's very interesting, and I think that it shows that we have to be careful to distinguish between assumptions and the reality on all different levels, and that in some cases, if the assumption gets to be confused with the reality, that's where we're in trouble. But if we recognize the assumptions as one thing, and sometimes the reality is being different and helping us to understand these patterns a little better, I think that's where we're helpful. I wanted to say, well, go ahead.
Research on support systems, whether possibly there's a difference between the amount of support that a woman who went on strike and therefore wasn't bringing home the wage would get from her family and that a man might get. We know from the auto workers that, you know, women took part in the strike, even though they weren't necessarily working there. I don't know if anybody's done any research on the kind of support or lack of that women get.
I'm not sure what you were referring to, the kind of support women get from the family.
There's women who are interested in unionizing, or were.
Yeah.
If they're talking about going out on strike, what kind of support do they get from their family for that? And if they aren't getting that support, is that possibly a reason why it's harder to talk about women?
Yeah, again, this raises the question of looking at different situations. In this particular place I've studied, the men and women were both unionized in separate industries, and the women were very supportive when they went on strike, which I think is one of the reasons both for the high level of organization of the women and the men, because the men, and I like to think of also getting away, or also looking at the support system as one of interdependence between the women and the men. Of course, I mean, we can't get away from the fact that women are certainly subordinate in this situation and dependent, but there's a way in which they were interdependent in some situations and could depend on each other. I don't think that has a real bearing on the activism.
Right, there and the collar workers, I mean, what you're saying is that there was a network of female family members who could support each other emotionally and financially if another was out on strike. Do you know how widespread that kind of thing is?
Well, unfortunately, it was long enough ago, and I don't have the kind of evidence where I, you know, I mean, I can't interview them, they didn't write diaries, There does seem to be some evidence in the garment industry that, for example, in the big 1909-1910 strikes, it looks as though those young single women were able to stay out of work as long as they did, A, because they were secondary wage earners in families, that is, they lived with, by and large, with parents who supported them, and B, because they lived in a community where the ethos of unionism, social justice, and so on was such that they could be supported. And it does look as though that was a factor in the success of that particular strike. But I think you'd have to answer that question in terms of both the economic, you know, sort of relationship of the striking wage earner to the rest of the family and in terms of the community from which that wage earner came. Is another example from the mill towns in Pennsylvania where a similar kind of thing happened, where the male fathers, usually heads of household or brothers, who are miners, are unionized, and the women who work in textile mills in those towns who are trying to unionize are supported by the males and the family while they conduct this unionization attempt, and they use the rationale of, after all, we belong to union families, to unionize. But I also know examples that are the opposite, that is, women who try to unionize who come from areas or families where there's no unionization, where unionizing is seen as not something that a woman would do. So I think you'd have to look at both those factors, but that both exist.
There is a difference between women's and men's labor force participation. I think that's clear. I mean, the idea is to look at differences between women and men without looking at them as opposite. And if you look at the difference between women's and men's labor force participation as being temporary versus permanent, we've got there this opposition in which one is exclusively one thing and the other is exclusively another thing. So I'm trying to look at the differences in a way which reflects the complexity of reality rather than positive to opposite.
I guess my point was then that I think when I was asked by someone to defend women's intermittent participation in the labor force, I found that by looking at statistics, I can't reduce that reality. I mean, women do work more intermittently than men. But I think that that also was forcing me to accept the whole economist human capital model of production, and when I began to see that, I began to see, for my work anyway, that dichotomization was not as useful and necessary, almost obliged me into their framework. If instead women's intermittent or anyone's participation in the labor force could be tied to their position in the family labor and in community labor, then they can be described as two separate phenomena that interact, but that aren't seen to be dichotomous, which I think almost implies, if written or inadvertently, that you're talking about the same beast, two sides of the coin, when we use that phrase. And I know that it doesn't necessarily need to be so, but I'm wondering if you've considered addressing your attention shifting your attention away from intermittent and continuous to the whole spectrum and process of labor with all the different types of labor that everyone in society.
I think that's a good suggestion. As I said, this is something that I've been working on recently. I think that that's part of rethinking some of these, is to look at a spectrum. On the other hand, one doesn't want to get into spectrums with stages either. That's another kind of model which I think has been overused, but I think that's a very good point.
I have a question. I read an article a couple of months ago in Power to Desire about the socialization of children and the way female children respond to each other and to their environment was very different from the way male children respond. but also have more bond and work in groups and play in groups. And the boy children tended to be more casual and to be more athletic and more zipping from place to place, just figuratively and really. And I think that really relates to how the women responded in the organization and the workplace. But what does that say to you about our nature as women? Is it that our socialization has already set in at such an early age and continues on? Or is it our nature as women?
You asked for
I actually think we should throw that question out to the floor.
Yeah, I'm not considered that.
Would someone like to respond to this?
What kind of search was it? What kind of situation were they?
It was
who set up the situation? How old were they? What class were they?
They were elementary age children.
How old?
I don't know. They were like 5, 6, very like early elementary age. Well, to the point where the girls were still playing with dolls and tea parties, and the boys were beginning to be athletic or whatever.
In
and
school?
Yes.
Who set up the
school?
Who set up the
I don't know.
And how is it set up?
Well, perhaps we don't need.
I'm going.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah. Although I'm not sure that where you're going will give us the kind of answer we want.
Is there a question of nature?
That's what I'm saying. Is
that
it,
comes
is it,
from such a study, or is it a question of how is this research done? asking that question on those things.
Louise, do you want?
Yeah. Well, I just would like to give an answer to that question also, without even knowing whether the research was well done. Socialization is not forever done when you're a child. It continues throughout your life, and it change and it does not lead you not to grasp opportunities, changing opportunities and changing structures when they happen to you. And any study that, I mean, any concept that something that happens to you when you're a child is going to shape you the rest of your life is just as bad and pernicious as if you're born, I think, because as you can see sort of from contemporary history, children who were raised in the 50s, girls, presumably playing with dolls and doing all those other things, are now going to medical school, law school, becoming business women, clawing their way up Wall Street, and so on. You know, so I mean, it's what happens when you're grown up, the opportunities that are there, rather than anything that happens when you're a child. But I have another point that I wanted to make, which is also in response to this, and that is really, with your presentations, of course, you're trying to integrate and to sort of set out a new way of looking at these things, and I think that's very useful, but because you sort of artificially broke away your sort of, at least Alice did, more so than Carol, probably, the work and family sort of shaping of opportunities of people's activism, you sort of came away, you moved away from the historical and the structural position of people at the time that they get to be active, at the historical moment. And what are they, what is their relationship with, what is happening in other unions, what are the different opportunities for different kinds of women workers, and so on. And I guess that's what troubled me. I know you couldn't give, the whole picture, but in order to sort of bring the structural and the historical back in, I think when you write this anyway, that I'd like to see it sort of carried into the workplace and into that activism and sort of turned into explanations about where these matters matter and where sort of structural situation matters.
Yeah, I agree that that's a problem, and it's always difficult, as you know.
Yes.
You know, when you think these issues, the complexities of making any statement as such that you need an article to justify a sentence, no matter where you go. But the question that I started out with, I started out by asking, does consciousness influence work culture? In other words, can you explain what happens on the shop floor, in terms of, of people's consciousness? That is that something that we can look at? Well, it seemed to me that the answer to that question was a self-evident yes. But, and so granted that all these other factors exist, that what actually happens on the shop floor is also a function of, you know, the community, other support systems, you know, and so on. But if you could hold all those other factors constant and just look at consciousness, then the next question is, would you then see a difference between male and female behavior? I think it's an intriguing question, not one I think that we can do more than play around with, as I suggested. And I guess what you're asking is whether that question really has any value. You see, I mean, I don't know whether it does in the end or not. It seems to me that it does, partly for the light that it will shed on contemporary behavior, and partly because, you know, since we are now in a situation where men and women both work frequently together, and where, you know, even the AFL-CIO has now begun to acknowledge the fact that they can't organize women the same way they organize men. You know, the question then is, you know, if you could isolate this separate consciousness, does it exist? And if you could isolate it, would it then help you to understand some of what's going on? So while I think you're absolutely right, I guess I don't quite know how to do all those things together, but I think the warning is well taken.
I'd just like to end by that, but I guess I would say, I think in some ways the danger of asking that question is that you sort of reify consciousness as this separate entity. And I think that particularly difference is very difficult to separate from its context. Difference means such different things in different contexts. It's like gender difference, the fact that women bear children is in some places a positive difference, in some places a negative difference, in some places a significant difference between women and men. And if you separate difference into some sphere that's like beyond the social context that gives it meaning, I think it's a very dangerous kind of reification that can lead to
Yeah, well, I hear what you're saying, but I guess I'm not a sociologist, I am a historian, and I really am rooted in the particular. That is, you know, although I like to play around with these generalizations, I mean, I think Louise is absolutely right. You know, you don't write them until you provide the framework and the structure for them. But then, you see, one has to go on from there to say, if you could never make, you know, if you could never ask such a question because it's dangerous, then surely you're losing a lot of sort of richness and depth that you could otherwise hang on to. Yeah?
It seems to be somewhat an answer to the question you asked before, just seeing that it's so broad. It is a continuity to a session that was held in this room this morning in Groszkoczewski and Lodi of France, where Roz did a whole survey of where feminist theory is today, going over various ways it's been treated, and the whole question of essentialism or biological difference comes into the theory even by the most well-intended feminist theories of Adrian Richard and Mary Daly, where the difference becomes a virtue, spirituality becomes a virtue. I don't want to repeat it because I'm not going to do it justice to repeat the session, but what strikes me is that you've both picked up on the same theme in your work as practitioners right now with the case, but to answer, I'm a historian, University of Tibet, Montreal, to defend the historians is broad-minded enough to speak to sociologists and anthropologists. What seems to come out of the historical study that Claudia Kuntz is doing on Nazi women was specifically very much enforces the separate spheres. She's not getting it. I mean, I don't think that's where she wants to leave it, but it was that a question about the oral interviews and histories done with wives of the commandants of Fort Campbell's support. The question was the conclusion was that a lot of the commandants functioned in their work as guards, none quit from the horror because their humanity was on a public stage as servants of the state. Their humanity was at home in the private sphere of women who were powerful, i.e. wives of German commandant heroes, retained the private stage. Even in the heartless world. The heartless world created by the servants, the impowerful, unpowerful Nazi commandant. In other words, I think one of the stages when you were given construction was, did public to private sphere ever really exist, or is it a construct theory? Claudia had an example of a specific historical.
Where it does exist.
Where it did, and she too came out urging what I think we're both were getting to in the end, was to recall a particular historical context. What group of people, when, what are they doing? What are we talking about? But there are historical examples that reinforce the difference. And the thing that the morning session was very rich was that all the themes, there are so many people here who were at that session, I hope they join in. The conclusions were going against the difference theory. I mean, it's where you were going in phase two, the Marxian perspective into biologism. I slip. I haven't quite followed you on the integrative conclusion because I sort of went into shock because this morning number two was critiqued quite thoroughly as biological differences. So if you haven't spoken with Chesky and Coons, they're onto something, but I think they've taken it a step beyond in critique of difference, in spite of everything you just said about the public parts.
Someone else who was
they didn't use the phrase KKK. I was wondering about that. You know, and the male guard is being, and that I think is very instructive in our new thinking of gender, where we want, where we think we really should be looking more.
Did they emphasize that this was through the fascist ideology that this was, this separation was sort of came out, or what was the implication of this?
Well, the old Nazi idea of Volksgemeinschaft being from now on the world.
Yeah, but this was a super implosion.
But the human roles were at the opposite poles.
But what I hear you.
Artificial thing.
Yeah. What I hear you both saying is that they were arguing that difference, as it was in fact used, was negative in consequence for women, which I
the way it was taken. To
yes, and I think, as I said, I think that that's a real danger. However, I don't think. Well, I think two things. I think one, that for all that you can say that, one nevertheless still has to ask the question of whether there is a different consciousness, however it is used. That is, I think one has to be historically accurate, and however it may now be changing, right? In other words, one has to ask the question of whether the capacity to use difference against women, it doesn't exist by virtue of the fact that women themselves feel that difference. And if that's the case, one can condemn the way it was used, but nevertheless acknowledge the historical reality that existed. And secondly, I think that one then has to ask in a sort of Hegelian way whether, if that's so, cannot you turn that notion on its head? That is, if difference can be used against, assuming that it exists, if it doesn't exist, we have no debate. But if it does exist, if difference can be used against women, then surely it can also be used for women. In other words, and as a weapon in the hands of women, whether it cannot be turned to their advantage, that it didn't happen that way in the Nazi period, and that it hasn't happened that way in the past, by and large for women, I would be the first to admit, but that it could not happen that way, I think is a subject that we have to question. Nadine, you had your hand up.
One thing on this, though, I think the one on the front of what other people are saying here is also a critique on whether the method view of the difference between male-female morality and what it's grounded in, is that if there is a difference between men and women, and it is grounded in whatever it's grounded in terms of consciousness through the family, consciousness through the workplace, or a combination of both, be careful of getting out of the biological determination argument. Because consciousness and culture, it can be very historically determined at times when and very contradictory at times, but it goes against it. But that neither women or patriarchy was in my next question, the difference in power relationships. But as long as men and women are culturally and ideologically and therefore economically defined, question to me, the more and more is in either of your readings and readings in the current feminist debate, how do you feel about the argument on patriarchy and in terms of locating, in some aspect, men's control over women, sexuality, reproduction, or labor, in terms of understanding some of the way this affects women's roles and consciousness and power.
I'm familiar with that, and I found it very intriguing. And I have to say that for this particular stuff I've done, I put it aside for the moment. So I'm not.
And I guess I'd like to avoid the question as well.
Maybe someone.
But we'd be delighted if somebody else. Anyone want to speak to Nadine's question? Go ahead.
Only in this way, it seems that if you look at the patriarchy as a political system, then you take a different look at the social construction of consciousness, which brings you a link between the consciousness in the home and the experience of one's reproductive system and consciousness in the workplace. Because look at some of the particulars of women in the choice of the victimization or struggle in the workplace. If she knows that she is a lower paid worker and is dependent in part for her living and material existence on having a man for another income. And if she knows that if she wants to have children, she will be an economic dependent, either on one man or on the family, then her choices in the workplace, what to struggle for, how hard to struggle, I think are influenced by that knowledge. I mean, it's interesting to see, I'm not sure that how it fits, but I think it's how it fits, that a lot of the struggle determination to get a lot of money comes from middle-class women who are educated and trained to their law degrees and so on. They are not as dependent as dependent on money on either a man or a coach to support them.
Okay. Let's see if we can get people who haven't spoken.
I have two points that I would like to make. One goes back to an earlier discussion, and that is that psychology, sociology, behavioral sciences are soft sciences, but if anything we have discovered is correct, then it would be impossible to assume that there would be no differences between men and women now, that we've got to take the differences for granted simply because to be a woman is to live from the first day of birth until the end of her life differently. Now, it doesn't have to be forever like that. And I think that the studies that talk about differences, sex differences in traits and behavior of children, for example, or grown-ups, should not be reported without statement of degree of overlap and the spread. Just to say, instead of saying men do this, more men or more boys play like that than girls, and then you discover tremendous overlap. So a significant difference, statistically, can be a very small difference for all practical purposes, mm-hmm. for purposes of social policy, because the overlap is greater. Mm-hmm. And now if I may be permitted as a sociologist to include history in the last 4 years, is it possible to talk about current history?
Sure.
that is, well, more than 4 years. A different attitude towards work on the part of college undergraduates whom I studied in the 40s and currently, just finished. In the 40s, women in one of the seven sister colleges wanted to work after college, partly as noblesse oblige, they owed to the, partly they had the feeling that the very experience of working for pay, magically, no matter what the skill, no matter what, will give them an insight in the world of their husbands and provide the kind of independence for a while, working until married or working until they have children, will give them the kind of experience that will last for life and that will serve them well in case of disaster, widowhood or divorce or something. Very different attitude in the attitudes of women whom I followed from class of 79 to 83. Their attitude towards work is rather close to men's attitude towards work. It is an important source of identity. They know that their life is going to be long, that at most one-seventh will be given over to child rearing, and they look towards work as a sense of identity, so that if someone asks, who are you, they will answer in part in their life through work. A meaningful attachment to some occupation mm-hmm. is much different, period.
Yeah. Awesome. it's interesting, and I think that's a big difference in consciousness, which I think in fact has existed. The Times a couple of days ago had an article about a research project which looked at college graduates from the women's colleges, from distinguished schools in 1967 and 77, and reported that something like 77% of the 1967 graduates worked, and that of those who worked, an enormous proportion, my memory is something like 40 or 50%, had advanced degrees, and more than 20% made more than $40,000 a year. In other words, it really confirms your research that work now is not simply something that women do to fill in gaps, but that the source of identity may have shifted, at least for this group of women, from home to work. And if that's so, then we might be able to see a narrowing of this sort of different consciousness in the future. So that's a sort of interesting. Well, okay, I was going to call on people who haven't spoken yet, so. I think it probably is around economics in large measure. I think the best way to respond to that is quite personally, which I grew up in Cardiff, which is a coal mining port in South Wales, whose livelihood depends on coal mining. And among the areas that it depends on are some area called Treforest and Pontypridd, which is one of the big, as you know, coal mining areas. And my closest childhood friend is married to a coal miner who works in Pontypridd and was one of the pit women. I mean, was one of the pit men. He's no longer working. He quit his job and is now working at the Mint, which is in Cardiff. But his wife is very much involved now. I don't know. I mean, when I hear what my friend Nora has to say about this, which is why I say it's a very personal response, and I don't know how general it is. This was a woman who'd never done anything political before, so she fits your definition. She responds by saying that it was neither the job nor the wage, it was the end of a lifestyle. In other words, they were going to close those pits up. They are going to close those pits up. Those pits are gone. And the result is an end of the entire sort of community structure, an end of the way that people live and how they relate to each other. And at least what she says, and she never has mentioned, you know, money or wages or job security in that way. What she does say is it's our lives and our homes, you know, that. So I'm not sure that that's, in other words, I'm not sure that the issue was economic in the narrow sense of that word, although surely it is in the broader sense of that word. But clearly it is in the, you know, in the broad sense. When the miners went back, she sent me these literally whole page, newspaper page clippings of the miners going back, led by women, which was really quite amazing, carrying banners that said, "For our lives and our children," was what the banners said in the picture that she sent me. Now, I don't know, you see, if that's the case, then I hadn't thought about it before, so it's an interesting question, but as I think about what I've been saying, it's really sort of consistent, in other words. It is exactly. In other words, it's a negation of public-private, you know, a sort of sense that really public-private exist in one sphere, not in separate spheres, but that how they could act really was in defense of this home, you know, which, however, rests in the jobs provided by the pits.
Yes. And the mine, the wives of the mine workers, I was wondering whether or not there was a precedent of anything, you know, whether or not there was a lot of women's activity taking place in it.
Yeah.
Whether or not you thought there was.
I don't know. Right.
Also led miners' strikes.
Not Nora's, you know. You know, the community she came from was a very, you know, the women did not work, they were very traditional, they were poor, they lived on the incomes of the husband, the families were traditional, and they had no sense of that history. In other words, that history, there was a strong miners' history, that is, Bernard, her husband, had a very strong militant stance, but she was really outside that, and this was the only time in the 30-odd years I've known her since I was six, right, that she has had any connection with this. And so I think this didn't come from that tradition. I think this really came from the threat of the jobs. And I don't, now she never mentioned connections with other women's groups. She is not a feminist. She's not, you know, this was her, you know, it was their struggle for their home. So I can't answer that question. I know in Yorkshire, in the northern mines, the Greenham women were much more active. It's possible that in the Welsh mines they simply were not. I mean, Wales got short shrift in that instance, as it does so often. I was going to say it wasn't the English miners' strike, it was the British miners' strike.
I think the point about community was very important. And I also think that the women's movement in England, from women other than Greenham especially, but other women too, gave the women miners a sense of support that what they were doing was not terrible, was not wrong, did not defy established authorities. One of my closest friends who lived in England, their union adopted a Yorkshire mining community. And one of the things is that they actually brought families to live in London for a period of time. And
the story they told me about the change in the consciousness is here is this man was coming in and talking about how the women were leading these demonstrations, and then in the same breath he talked about how he couldn't understand men doing housework, and so a friend of mine who actually was a man, so I was ironing a shirt, you know, it was going on and on. Mm. But the women, many of the women coal miners were actually met by feminists, and I know, for example, the Yorkshire, the secretary treasurer of the Yorkshire women's organization is Jean McCrindle, who was a
historian. A feminist historian.
So I think there really was a real connection between women and the women's movement, giving support, and I think it provided an extra
That's interesting. The real question is whether that, whether the kind of support they gave was derivative of what the women, wives of miners and so on, wanted and developed, or whether it really created a consciousness. And that would actually be an interesting question to explore in terms of the issues that you're raising, which I mean, it's actually a golden opportunity for somebody to go do some interviewing and talking to find out exactly what happened in people's minds. We have time for one more question. Anybody who hasn't asked one yet? So, go ahead.
I came here late, so I don't know whether my question has already been covered. I hear a lot of discussion about consciousness, but I'm still not sure whether I know or understand from this session if there is any theory of consciousness. And what is very broad, but what is consciousness? Consciousness has been discussed in terms of attitudes, in terms of identity, in terms of participation in strikes, in terms of other kinds of activities. It has been interchangeably used by concepts such as ideology or culture or what have you. But is there any theory of consciousness? And is consciousness anything specific to women by class, by gender, by nationality, what have you? And is it in fact important for us to try to discuss the question of consciousness and clarifying it further for an understanding of culture and work?
I think we should pass on that, since actually the first two presentations we did sort of come to terms with a definition for our purposes, which we've been using. I don't really think it serves much function at this point to sort of try to expand that or to debate it. So we probably should pass. And on that note, we should call this workshop to a halt. Thank you.
Thank you very much.